Welcome to The Science of Murder. This is a new podcast that discusses the intersection of crimes, mostly murder and serial killings, and the science that is used to catch the perpetrators. We will shine the spotlight on some of the people responsible for the advances in science and techniques that were used to catch the murderers. We will also discuss times where science, or the people wielding it, failed in their quest, and how many notorious serial killers managed to evade being discovered, as well as how they were ultimately caught and convicted. My name is Lissa, and I'll be your host for the discussions of the science of murder. I am not a forensic scientist, psychologist, or legal professional. I'm just one of the many people who are interested in the topic of true crime and its perpetrators. I am curiously fascinated in the how and why these crimes happen, and how science has developed to catch and convict these criminals. I'm here to open up these conversation topics that still aren't quite acceptable to the mainstream, but also ground them in my own love of science, scientific techniques, and psychological studies. I know I'm not the only one out there fascinated by the science of murder and true crime, so I want us to find each other and learn together. This talking, on a podcast is a little bit harder than I thought it would be, but it's something that I really want to do and want to share and maybe, you know, see who else is out there that is interested. Today is Sunday, February 11th, 2024, and it is also known as the International Day of Women and Girls in Science. I thought it was fitting that we begin this series of podcasts by focusing on a woman who was instrumental in advancing the science of crime investigations as we discuss the science of murder. Today we are talking about Frances Glessner Lee, who is colloquially known as the Mother of Forensic Science. Frances was born in Chicago in 1878. She was the child of John Glessner of Warner, Bushnell, and Glessner, which eventually became known as International Harvester. As both a woman in the late 19th century and as a wealthy heiress of a society family, she had a very expected path in life. As a woman for a time, she was expected to sit back, be quiet, marry well, and have children to continue the family legacy. She and her brother were mostly homeschooled, though her brother did go on to study at Harvard. From a young age, while her family summered in the White Mountains in New Hampshire, Frances would often accompany local doctors on their home visits, and she learned the skills of nursing. In fact, she was fascinated with science and medicine, though it would have been unusual for a young woman of her social standing to pursue such a career. Her father even forbid her to do so. However, Frances had a very active mind and loved to read. One of the authors she latched onto as a young woman is Arthur Conan Doyle and his fictional detective Sherlock Holmes. Sherlock is still a huge cultural phenomenon and one of the best-known fictional characters ever known. Even over a century later, but in the late 19th century, his existence was groundbreaking for his proficiency with observation, deduction, forensic science, and logical reasoning that borders on the fantastic. These are qualities that Frances continued to champion throughout her life. Another implied influence on her fascination with legal science was H.H. Holmes. He was an American serial killer active between 1891 and 1894 in Chicago, where Frances grew up. In July 1895, when Frances was 17, Chicago police and reporters began investigating Holmes' building in Inglewood, now locally referred to as the Castle. Though many sensational claims were made, no evidence was found which could have convicted Holmes in Chicago. Despite that, this would have been a media sensation through Chicago, as it was throughout the country. Perhaps it was this failure of law enforcement that was also part of her inspiration in later years. As a young adult, Frances proceeded along her expected path of marrying and having children by marrying corporate attorney Blewett Lee in 1898 and having three children. Despite the novelty at the time, they later divorced in 1914. What was not expected was that while in private, Frances latched on to any source of education that was available to her. Despite not having attended formal education, She continued to read and learn all she could. She also enjoyed creative endeavors such as needlepoint, sewing clothing for her children and herself, and devising elaborate centerpieces. In 1912, she decided to recreate the Chicago Symphony Orchestra in miniature as a gift to her mother. It was an extremely intricate scale model that fascinated all who saw it. The skills she learned doing this would play a huge role in her future pursuits. Eventually, she met a friend of her older brother, George McGrath, who was the Boston Medical Examiner from 1907 to 1935. They shared interests in crime and education. They became close companions, and Francis became his biggest supporter and benefactor for the rest of his life. McGrath was a medical examiner who was frustrated by the system around him in the early 20th century. He pushed for advancements in legal medicine, even taking time to travel to London and Paris to study their systems and processes. After this year-long sabbatical, he returned to incorporate what he had learned into the courses he still taught at Harvard and into his work as a medical examiner. After her brother died in 1930, leaving Lee in control of much of the family fortune, she invested a lot of time and money as a benefactor to McGrath and a trailblazer in the field of forensic science. In 1931, she endowed the McGrath Library of Legal Medicine in his name and prompted the creation of the Department of Legal Medicine at Harvard. She inserted herself wildly into the development of this new department, insisting on being the curator for the library, to which she contributed her large collection of medical books, and insisting that McGrath be instituted as director of this department with herself as his assistant. He also approached the director of the Medical Sciences Division of the Rockefeller Foundation for support in developing a fellowship program to train doctors in legal medicine, similar to the programs they had already supported for psychiatry and other specialties. She championed the cause of legal medicine wherever she could. In addition to supporting McGrath, his career, and his finances, she dedicated herself to this pursuit. She even met with J. Edgar Hoover at the newly reconstructed FBI to push her ideas of legal medicine, i.e. forensic science, forward. Despite Hoover's known chauvinism, he had fired all of the existing female agents upon becoming director and refused to hire more. He was able to see sense in her ideas, and Frances had a way of ingratiating herself and bulldozing forward when she was dedicated to an idea. She mentioned the 1928 National Research Council's bulletin on coroner and the medical examiner, and its mostly ignored recommendations in advancing legal medicine. He offered the department at Harvard as a possible resource for the FBI. Next, she worked on getting her vision of the Department of Legal Medicine at Harvard up to her vision. Unfortunately, McGrath's health was failing, and his choice of successor was difficult because of his mostly self-educated status in a nascent field. They decided to choose a young pathologist from Chicago named Alan Moritz and set him up to get him to speed to lead the department. They granted him a professorship and sent him off to Europe on a fellowship to study with various leaders in medical legal studies, much like McGrath had done earlier in his career. Moritz also used this time to define what the focus of medical legal practice should and would be, and how he saw that developing at Harvard. Moritz ended up writing a book following his fellowship in Europe called The Pathology of Trauma, and that book was dedicated to Frances Glessner Lee. Whatever their personal relationship, Frances was instrumental in the opportunities presented to Moritz and was dedicated to advancing the study of what was to become forensic science. She was known to frequently host elaborate dinner parties, but instead of the usual high society guests, she invited medical professionals, police officers, and investigators, and encouraged them to share their stories and knowledge of crimes. While never formally educated, she made it her mission to learn all that she could to advance her cause. Lee herself said of her life's work, "My whole object has been to improve the administration of justice, to standardize the methods, to sharpen the existing tools, and to make it easier for law enforcement officers to do a good job and to give the public a square deal. We continue to strongly champion science as a part of crime investigations. The first step toward this was getting doctors trained in legal medicine and getting their usefulness recognized. In addition to her work spearheading the creation of the Department of Legal Medicine at Harvard, one of the causes she advanced to this effect was the idea that coroners should be replaced by medical professionals, especially those educated in death investigation. The coroner is a government or judicial official who is empowered to conduct or order an inquest into the manner or cause of death. However, qualifications for coroners are set by their local jurisdictions, and in many jurisdictions, little or no training is required. Some coroners are elected and some are appointed. In the U.S., the terms coroner and medical examiner vary wildly in meaning by jurisdiction, as do qualifications and duties for those offices. A coroner may have no legal or medical training at all. There was much resistance to changing the largely political nature of the coroner system. While Frances was not able to effect the change she wished, she persevered in lobbying changes to the legal system and rallying others to her cause. She also did what she could to advance the education of doctors, with Harvard at the leading edge of this cause, because medical examiners in the scope that Frances was proposing simply didn't exist. To be honest, in 2024, they still don't. The next focus of her cause was the education of crime scene investigators. Police officers were often the first people present at the crime scene and often the only ones. They needed to be trained so as to not compromise the crime scene. She began by hosting 1 or 2 day conferences between police supervisors and the Department of Legal Medicine at Harvard. The conferences consisted of sessions on preserving evidence at crime scenes, weapons and ammunition, information on deaths by violence and poisoning, and presentations about autopsies by Moritz. Lee believed that police officers, especially homicide investigators, needed to be taught not only to not destroy potential evidence at a crime scene, but how to recognize and preserve it. Any error or oversight could potentially alter an investigation. She wanted to teach these techniques during her seminars, but was unable to provide the attendees with actual crime scenes. The suggested media of pictures and movies would be insufficient to create the organic experience of discovering clues. Upon remembering her previous experience of creating miniatures of the symphony, she landed on the idea of doing the same to create immersive crime scenes. Her greatest legacy became a series of miniature crime scene dioramas known as the Nutshell Studies of Unexplained Death. These tiny scale models are still used today to educate crime scene investigators. These dioramas are detailed representations of death scenes that are based on composites of actual court cases and represented at a 1 inch to 1 foot or 1 to 12 scale. Her goal in these nutshell studies was to create a tool that would help investigators learn to analyze crime scenes. It was important to her that these scenes were as realistic as possible, not to be dismissed as playing with dollhouses, but taken seriously as teaching tools. Because of this, her attention to detail within the scenes is breathtaking. These death scenes that were based on her knowledge and self-study seem to highlight Frances's dissatisfaction with domestic life while providing valuable teaching tools. In all, Frances's life as a whole contradicts the trajectory followed by most upper-class socialites and is recognized that her choice of a traditionally feminine medium clashes strongly with the diorama's macabre subject matter. This juxtaposition is itself a valuable expression of art outside of their purpose as an investigative training tool. In all, Frances made 20 of these scale models. Lee died in 1962 at the age of 83. The 20 nutshell studies she made were used at Harvard for HAP seminars and as teaching aids until 1966, when Harvard's legal medicine department was dissolved. One of these nutshells has been lost to time, and one is in the custody of the Society for the Protection of New Hampshire Forests, courtesy of the Bethlehem Heritage Society, after it was rediscovered at the site of Lee's former home in Bethlehem, New Hampshire. The other 18 are in the custody of the Maryland Medical Examiner's Office in Baltimore, Maryland, where they are on permanent loan and still used for forensic seminars. These surviving scenes were reunited, restored, and exhibited at the Renwick Gallery of the Smithsonian from October 20th, 2017 to January 28th, 2018. As I look at these scenes, I'm fondly reminded of the sixth season of CSI, where the investigators focused on the so-called miniature killer, and how fascinated I was by these tiny scale models of crime scenes, not knowing of their connection to real crime investigation history. The killer in these episodes, along with her father, constructed extremely detailed recreations of the murder she committed, down to recreating blood pools with the victim's own blood, and left them at the scenes of the crimes with hidden clues for the investigators. Similarly, with Francis' models, investigators are invited to study each diorama in depth, applying investigative techniques and logic. They then fill in the story's gaps with ideas and possibilities colored by their own tastes and influences, designing a logical narrative of what happened in each frozen scene. While the original solutions are kept largely under wraps, solving the crime is not actually the point of these crime scenes. Rather, it is to focus on the evidence provided and produce a workable narrative of the crime presented to them. Is it a murder? Suicide? A robbery gone wrong? What do they see at the crime scene that supports their position, and what paths of investigation does it open before them to support their theory? After all, for Francis, it wasn't about answers, but teaching crime scene investigators how to ask the questions. In a quote attributed both to her and a detective of her acquaintance, it is said that she named her models based on the idea that, as the investigator, you must bear in mind that there is a twofold responsibility. Clear the innocent as well as expose the guilty. Seek only the facts. Find the truth in a nutshell. She created all these models, nutshells, incredibly detailed crime scenes based on actual cases, scenarios taken from real-life crimes, accidental deaths, and suicides, and combined them with anecdotes from police officers, medical examiners, and morgue workers. She also recreated cases described in her many field books and manuals with an astonishing degree of realism. There are working window and door latches, working lights, appropriately discolored corpses, minuscule bullet holes, tiny hand-rolled cigarettes, intricate props and pieces of evidence. Each scene is meant to be an immersive representation of an actual crime that challenges the trainee's powers of observation and deduction. To further this realism, each of the dioramas is accompanied by a crime scene report to encourage approaching each scene as a real-life investigation. The victims of each diorama were dolls that were all handmade and decorated by Francis, who cut and sewed all the clothes by hand, even going so far as to knit tiny socks with straight pins to make them as realistic as possible. Francis also painted each victim to represent scientific clues, such as tiny bite marks left by an assailant. To ensure the scene was complex enough to be realistic, Lee overstuffed it with props that might be important to the case. For example, many nutshells include details like the previously mentioned tiny hand-rolled cigarettes, hand-painted wall calendars with appropriate dates, scale model clothespins whittled from wood, medicine bottles with hand-painted prescription labels, little envelopes complete with little stamps, and date-accurate headlines on miniature newspapers. These were in addition to the instruments and decorations of death, like tiny bloody knives or blood spatter patterns on the wallpaper. The most elaborate diorama Lee built consists of two nearly identical side-by-side scenes. On the left, a room is depicted in the moment after a man is shot to death. He sprawled on the living room floor. Next to it was a nearly identical room. It depicts the same scene after a trooper fully moved the victim to the couch. A trooper is standing, taking tiny, indecipherable notes with a pencil made from a toothpick with a real lead. Also in the scene, the wife is sweeping up the debris of china left broken when her husband collapsed. Although at first glance they appear nearly identical, there are more than 30 differences between the two scenes that the student observing them is expected to detect. Unfortunately, this diorama, Two Rooms, was irreparably damaged or destroyed in the late 1960s. Some of the other scenes represented in these nutshells include a man is found hanging from the eaves of a barn. The barn is filled with straw and various farm implements. A horseshoe, open side down, adorns the door. A tiny wasp nest is nestled in the eaves. Francis based the scene on an old case of McGrath's, where a man routinely threatened suicide to get his way, until one day the box he was standing on broke and he died unexpectedly. In a bathroom, a strangled woman is found on the floor. There are no signs of forced entry. Close observation of the diorama reveals small threads hanging from the door that match the fibers found in the wound around the dead woman's neck. A stool lays nearby. That, along with the included witness statements, allows one to deduce that the woman in question used the stool to hang herself from the bathroom door. In another diorama, the burned cabin, months were spent on its detailed construction, only for it to be subsequently torched by a blowtorch to accurately depict evidence of a fire. A charred skeleton is lying in the burned bed. Frances wrote of her process, "I have in prospect or completed two hangings, two shootings, two assaults with blunt weapon, one natural cause, one drowning, one found dead, one arson. I do not yet know how that gentleman was killed. Open to suggestions. And one poison," she told Moritz. "I need more traffic accidents, hit and run, collision and non-collision, with some good evidence, shreds of clothing, etc., but not too commonplace or obvious. Also, another shooting or two, stabbing, more poisonings, carbon monoxide, and a couple of puzzling found deads." While the crime scenes themselves include a few assumptions based on Frances's own privileged upbringing, she championed a focus on society's invisible victims. She was devoted to the search for truth and justice for everyone, and she often featured victims such as women, the poor, and people living on the fringes of society, where cases might be overlooked or tainted with prejudice on the part of the investigator. She wanted to teach investigators to recognize and overcome any unconscious biases and to treat each case with rigor, regardless of the victim. She hosted bi-yearly seminars focused on investigative techniques, assisted by these models and lectures from experts. She created a fraternity-like atmosphere among the attendees of these seminars and encouraged them to take what they had learned back to their precincts and careers, to take their new skills and use and spread them to others. She also encouraged them to see each other as part of an elite brotherhood that they could rely on for assistance and support. Due to her dedication to justice, in 1943, Frances Glessner Lee was commissioned as captain by the New Hampshire State Police, the first woman to hold the position. Additionally, she was the first female member of the International Association for the Chiefs of Police and of the American Academy of Forensic Science. She endowed and then taught at Harvard's Department of Legal Medicine. She is considered the godmother of forensic science. Frances is known as having created her nutshells using traditionally feminine crafts to advance in a male-dominated field and having established herself as one of its leading voices. Upon a cancer diagnosis that she thought would end her life, she established a trust and formed the Frances Glessner Lee Foundation to continue sponsorship of the homicide seminars for police officers and Harvard Associates in Police Science. She did die in 1962, but her legacy continues on today with these nutshells painstakingly preserved and still used to educate law enforcement on the investigation of crime scenes. Over her lifetime, Lee received many honors and awards. She was given an honorary doctorate of laws from New England College in 1956 and an honorary law degree from Drexel University in 1958. Lee was an honorary captain in the Maine State Police, the Vermont State Police, the Massachusetts State Police, the Virginia State Police, the Connecticut State Police, and the Chicago Police Department, an honorary major in the Kentucky State Police, and an honorary captain in the U.S. Navy. The Institute of Medicine of Chicago created a category for Lee, Citizen Fellow of the Institute of Medicine, in recognition of her extraordinary contributions to the advancement of legal medicine and forensic pathology. In her own words, "There is no place for guesswork in any sort of police work whatever, especially not in homicide investigation. The investigator seeks out the truth, whole, naked, incontrovertible truth, let it finish where it may. He is not protecting or avenging anyone, but is seeking, through patient, painstakingly accurate hard work, what happened, never making a guess and then searching for evidence to support it. Patience, an infinite capacity for taking pains, absolute accuracy, thoroughness, there is no substitute for these. If you cannot approach a case with these convictions, you should resign at once. There is no place for you either in police work. Say to yourself over and over, there is absolutely no place for guessing in police work, and perhaps you will learn it." This is the legacy of Frances Glessner Lee, the mother of forensic science. If you would like to learn more about Frances Glessner Lee and the development of forensic science in the United States, I recommend reading 18 Tiny Deaths, The Untold Story of the Woman Who Invented Modern Forensics by Bruce Goldfarb. Thank you for learning along with me. I'd also love to hear from you on social media or email about this topic or any future ones you'd like to suggest. You can find me on Instagram or Patreon as Science of Murder. It can also be reached at scienceofmurder@gmail.com. If you haven't already, please like and subscribe to this podcast to continue learning about the science of murder. Next week, we'll discuss the science of trace evidence in murder investigations. I hope you enjoyed this first lesson and continue to tune in to learn about the science of murder. Please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcast provider. Encourage your accomplices, I mean friends, to learn along with us.